You are listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network.
OneOfUs.net has been your one-stop shop for all things geek for years. But there's a side to them many of you have never heard. The subscription side. Subscribe and listen to great podcasts like The Breakfast Pub, The Original Gentleman, and the Watch a Movie With Us series. Head on over to OneOfUs.net and don't forget your towel.
Well, South by Southwest 2017 is over. Oh, thank God.
I think I'm still in the line for something. I'm not sure.
It does feel that way. I'm having nightmares about queuing.
I feel like I'm still getting turned away from a line.
Yeah, there was a decent amount of that this year.
Well, seeing as how your mic was the last one to work, that might have been...
probably so.
That was almost the case.
I know that we've got the whole gang here, people who were there on the whole, going around.
Herman.
Richard.
Martin.
Patience.
JC.
Casca.
Casca.
Yeah, man, it's one syllable.
Casca.
I like that. It's kind of like your hip hop name. Yeah. It should be like a dollar sign.
Yeah. Well, double dollar sign. But
yeah, there you go.
Semantics.
And we did a variety of stuff. I mean, I know I, outside of drinking heavily with and getting free stuff with Martin,
a lot of that.
Yeah, there was a lot of that. But on the whole, I was definitely seeing movies. But a lot of you guys did a lot of other stuff as well, including music. I'm just curious to start with. Just to talk about that first real quick, what were the standout music things that y'all did this year?
Oh, you're looking at me. I guess that means me. Uh-huh. I actually only made it to one show this year, which was fine because it was a good one. It was Busta Rhymes. He played a super secret show for Samsung Next. And I found out, got the invite on Reddit like the night before and RSVP'd and just got in, just squeaked in there really quick. And it was cool. After waiting in line for 3 hours and listening to Kid Capri DJ the greatest hits for another 2 hours, Busta came out wasted. With a bottle of Crevassier in hand,
yeah.
Sprayed the audience with champagne, which is always fun when you have to drive home later. And but otherwise, it was a pretty good gig. Busta definitely he brought it. Busta brought it, and he did not want to stop until finally he was just too drunk.
Until the rhymes were busted.
Yeah. And then I'm getting home at 5 o'clock in the morning.
That's because flip mode is the greatest.
Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how did you enjoy the flip?
So that was my only music experience,
yeah.
But it was a good one.
Fair enough. I know, Martin, you went to see a regular...
Yeah. They only come to town for South by Southwest, and I go see Chihiro Yamasaki and the Route 14 Band at the Elephant Room. I skipped them last year because the year before I caught maybe three of their four gigs, so I figured I'd give it a break. But this time they were there one night. And I get there early enough, a few hours early, to catch the other jazz acts before them. And as much as everybody gives La La Land shit for, hey, it's about a white guy who teaches the world about jazz, there were really no black people on stage or in the audience other than me and one of the other guys there. But the two best bands, other than Chihiro Yamasaki, was a group of old guys who I guess play here in town. Tony Mills, I think, were their names. But I'm like, ooh, they play at the Elephant Room the first Wednesday of every month. So I'm like, okay, I got something new to see. But Chihiro Yamasaki, she did not disappoint. I mean, that little girl, she can blow the hell out of a trumpet. It's an amazing show. And I got some friends to come along and see where I could go, see?
I've been telling you,
yeah. Huh. So that was my one music thing, but it was a blast.
Right, Kyle, you went to go see a ton of stuff.
Oh my gosh, I think I did. I might have done more music this year than Casca. There's other Kyles. No, the probably I think the fan favorite thing I got to do this year is I got to see Survive play for the first time.
They did
so
good.
The theme song, The Stranger Things. Oh my gosh. And a bunch of other just amazing. I fell in love when they did those tracks for the guest soundtrack. Oh, that really great film. And then I got treated to a surprise show last minute. I got to go see Pennywise and Jimmy Eat World.
Awesome.
Oh, man, was this amazing.
I love Pennywise. They're so great.
You know that song? What is the name of it? It's like their hymn song. They've been playing it. Anyways, it's a song about like one of their friends who committed suicide or died. I don't remember the story, but I just remember being 13 years old watching this music video of everybody freaking out singing this song. And I'll be damned if that same thing didn't happen, complete with like people stage diving and like, you know, rushing the mic and everything. It was phenomenal, pretty awesome. And then my favorite standout was this girl, TK. That's capital T-K-A-Y, TK. M-A-I-D-Z, Mazda, it sounds like, for her last name. Maybe that's like an endorsement thing. But no, just one of these random stages I walked into. And honestly, at first, I thought I was in a Zumba class. This girl had like long braids down to her lower back with beads at the end, and she just like really getting into it. She had a poofy orange jacket, like it was wintertime, and we're all just sweating, and then bright orange overalls. But soon she took the jacket off and just really killed it, like a mix of like hip-hop and then some pop-type music. I don't know. This is, yeah, I could probably go into like 10 other ones, but I'd, you know, just hijack. Yeah, those are the highlights, I believe.
Anybody else?
Yeah, this year, because of book scheduling problems, I couldn't make it to my one fixture, which is the Japan Night gig at...
usually if I ever go anywhere from music,
it's
that's
so good. But I was like, I really don't feel like... It was a horrible combination of I had other stuff to do. It was... And Friday was St. Patrick's Day, and I'm like, St. Patrick's Day on 6th Street? No, not even Japan Night. So I went to the preview day instead on the Thursday, which was just as much fun. Wow, the 80s are back in amazing fashion in Japan. Analogics and Satellite Young, LEDs and weird wraparound frames and electropop, and they were glorious. They were just such good fun, particularly Analogics, who were, you know, just... feel like they fell out of some weird Japanese The Fix tribute act and decided to go even stranger. They were wonderful. They were one of my favorite things about South by this year. But pretty much one of the few musical things I caught, so...
Well, Chihiro Yamasaki usually plays Japan Night. I mean, you might have seen him.
Oh, yeah, probably so.
Huh. Chris, did you see anything?
No.
The only thing
hates people.
I did actually stumble into something I loved, because on the last night I was like, fuck this, I'm going to the Nomad. And showing up there having a not South by Southwest band night, but with people who flew in for this, who were like, I don't know if they couldn't get into Southwest or it was an extra show, but I stumbled this band called Bad Luck, that just two dudes, a drummer and a saxophonist. And the saxophonist was playing through it was playing through various pedals, where I forget what they call it when you can do a sample and then press it to play back, so he was layered, you know.
A looper.
And then the drummer had a variety of different types of sticks, including at one point he was playing with two sticks in each hand and was doing weird staccato rhythms with it. I've never seen anybody do that before. But they were kind of like, I was like, they're John Zorn playing the songs of Angelo Badalamenti is what it sounded like. And I was like, just entranced. Like, oh my God, this is amazing. I actually went up to the drummer afterwards, just was like, you're awesome.
Fangirl.
Totally.
You know, real quick on music, I just forgot. You guys have heard a drum machine before, right? Like on a song?
Yeah.
I went into this concert for the National Geographic party, and they had a giant machine that played drums, like this huge tower in the middle of the stage with drums all over it, and it was like one of those machines you put a quarter in and wind it, and then it just starts going. But they have this thing programmed, and it played the drums to all their songs, and they just played violin and cello on top of it.
Nice.
Yeah. Literal drum machine.
Well, a funny anecdote is, I know South by comedy is always a big thing, and I always would like to make it out to something. But I knew I wasn't really going to have time this year, and I was kind of bummed out that I wasn't going to see Hannibal Buress, because I knew he was in town. He ended up kind of crashing the Q&A for The Big Sick at the Paramount. So he asked the first question, and him and Kumail Nanjiani had like a funny back and forth for like 2 or 3 minutes of the Q&A, just talking about how apparently they were roommates at one point, and Hannibal kind of lived with Kumail during part of the story in real life, and so they kind of talked about that back and forth, and so I was like, I got to see Hannibal Buress, and I was like totally in the same room with him.
That guy comes to South By and he just pops up as a guest star in everything.
I saw last year him crash like 3 different Q&As. He just showed up, and they're like, why are you even here? You
didn't
even get that.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of comedy shows, and it would always be, oh, we got a surprise guest.
Yeah.
And the first time it was like, oh, it's awesome. And the second time it's like, wow, he's back. And the third time it's like, all right, I think he's just at these things.
Well, I mean, South By, the film part is, I think, the most guilty of all film festivals, of people like asking like, well, what's your advice for me as an aspiring screenwriter? And just questions like that we all roll our eyes at film festivals.
Somebody at the live Q&A actually said, can I get all your autographs?
Yeah.
To which the response was, No! Fuck off! Throw them out! Yeah. I hate South by Q&A audience is the fucking worst. Yeah. Maybe the worst of any festival I have ever been to on two continents!
That's just saying a lot because most Q&As are awful.
Which is why...
Past the fifth question, I'm out.
Which is why the Q&A for Free Fire this year was the best Q&A I've possibly ever been to because Ben Wheatley was not having it. He was just immediately giving everybody who asked a stupid question the shit they deserved. And by the end of it, Armie Hammer almost fell over laughing and was like, and said that was the greatest Q&A of all time.
That's great.
That's good.
There was a funny moment in the Big Sick one as they were trying to wrap it up, but there was still like four people and they were like, all right, rapid fire, just ask the question and we'll answer it. And Judd Apatow was there. And I don't even remember what the question was. And Judd was like, 9 inches. And then
he went, Chris goes like, so how do you decide what shots are the right shots? You know, one of those dumb things. Yeah. And he goes, yeah, I'm the director. That's my whole job.
Now, I did see a really terrible, I think the worst Q&A I've ever been to. And it was for, what was the movie called? California Dreams. And the director, when he brought him out, he was like, yeah, they took me out drinking last night, so I might be a little hungover. You're like, all right. When he comes back out, he would just not... He would answer questions only at one- or two-word answers. And it was just like, dude, I'm expecting the questioners to be the shitty ones. Don't you want to promote and talk about this? And or he just look around like, I don't know what to do here.
Chris Herman said something like that with Ridley Scott during Alien.
Oh, I mean, that was one of my favorite moments of the festivals. When they were introducing this kind of anniversary kind of showing of the theatrical release of Alien, the theatrical version, Ridley Scott came out and was going to introduce the cast of Alien Covenant. And he forgot everyone's names. Like, he started out saying Catherine Waterston, but he just said, Cat... and he just forgot. Then he said Danny, and then Michael Fassbender just quickly got right behind Danny McBride.
Right.
Like, I'm just going
to
do
you
it.
You had all that to make it entertaining, plus Ridley Scott really need to sell himself or his new movie.
No, not really.
But you know, a little guy, indie director who's got something here,
sure.
Man, I need you to talk about this. Mm-hmm. I decided to stick around for it. And you're too hungover, just too cool.
My favorite bizarre Q&A was for... they did retrospective screenings of Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon.
Beautiful.
Which I adore that film. They decided to do the Q&A before the film. The first question they asked was, who here has seen this film before? There was like three of us in a large room. And they were like, we're just going to go to the bar.
and you have nothing to ask.
Well, you're burying the lead there on stage for that Q&A.
Oh, yes.
Robert England.
Yeah. Robert England was there. And he was just like weird and poetic, and like all his answers to the questions were just like, what? Okay. And he was steaming drunk and clearly just very happy to be around people he hadn't seen in years.
Yeah.
So we're all like, great, we get to see a great film as well.
You went to go see that too.
No, I missed it, unfortunately. I had to.
Oh,
and
you
that
were so
was
excited.
Like, I know, I was super stoked because I really wanted to see Robert England too. But my weirdest Q&A, believe it or not, was for 68 Kill. It was very clear that everyone had been drinking heavily, and the main female character, the blonde, at one point got on her back and started dry humping the air violently.
That sounds about right for that movie.
Yeah.
It was, and everyone was just like, okay. She wasn't even asked a question.
Oh, okay.
She was just started doing that.
She was just doing her thing. Yeah.
Wow. So they just like, that film was like cinema verite. Is
right.
Wow.
Do you think it would make the Q&As better if they used that app that they had in Ballroom D? Did you guys see that? Where you essentially put your question in a text and then they all congregate on a screen and then they get to pick which question to answer.
Oh,
I think they'd be improved if they borrowed William G. Castle's equipment from The Tingler. Anybody who asks a dumb question is immediately violently shocked straight out. It's like, what did you shoot on? 20 volts. You know.
2018 technology improvements.
Everyone who stepped up to the mic to ask a question, if you saw a red laser dot on the screen.
I have to say, Martin and I, thanks again, Martin, for showing up. We did actually, Beginner's Guide to South by panel, which is great fun, but I swear to God, if another person had asked us, how do the express passes work?
Oh.
How do the mentor sessions work? I was actually going to get up and beat somebody with a chair. Because the sixth time, I'm like, because, you know, the first couple times I was like, there's a lot of people here who don't speak English as the first language, so maybe there's some clarifiers,
maybe
some technical
some
details.
Maybe handouts or something. And then I was, ask these questions.
I really was, by the sixth one, I was like, are you just not paying attention?
I was there to witness that, and the one guy is actually, I'm sorry, can you just explain that one more time? I still don't understand.
Okay,
I'm
getting mine
harassed
so much.
By Hans Molman.
You're right. It was bad. I didn't mind as much because, one, I didn't know how it worked. So I was like, oh, this is educational. But more so because, to me, that was eclipsed by the woman who couldn't figure out her guide.
Ooh, angry.
And was just angry. And she was almost like, when is one of you going to step down and show me how to do this and walk me through it? It was just kind of
like in reference to her phone app.
I'm not text.
How come they don't give out a book that tells you how to do it?
They
right
do.
There. Matter of fact, it's in
your bag.
She
was starting to concern me quite badly, actually.
Well, true.
But the panel was great fun.
It was a lot
of
fun.
It was a blast. I mean, I love doing that.
No, you have a great way of opening that when you ask, has anybody been to this panel before? And when people raise their hand, you go like, why are you here?
what did we fail at last time?
Well, the interesting thing about that is there was a change to the Express Pass line, and I didn't know about it, so as soon as I learned about it,
left. You learned what you fucked up. Yeah. Fuck you. God damn it. Empty seat. Somebody in the standby line could have got in, but you were like, I'm in, and they're like, oh, we're gone now. It's like,
Well, all of the festival, every time I made a friend in line or sitting next to, and they looked at my badge and saw I said speaker and asked what I was speaking on, and I told them the title of the panel, they were all, everyone I was like, oh, I wanted to go to that. I should have known about that. I got to do that next year.
I did get a Q&A bucket list this year and got to see Crispin Glover on a panel, which is exactly as batshit insane as you would think.
American
Gods, where they're just like, his character's named Mr. World, and every time they asked him a question, he just went, well, I am the world, I am the children. And that was all.
I am not shocked nor surprised.
And of course, Ian McShane was like, Ian McShane the whole time. He's like, yeah, I'm the one everybody wants to hear talk, so I'm going to talk.
He's not wrong.
He's not wrong.
Ian McShane, who's returned to British television after when he had an early successful career, and then it kind of went away, and then he came back in the 80s in a series where he played an adorable antique dealer / private detective.
Yeah, Lovejoy.
Lovejoy,
yeah. Now he's like, I turn up and swear on American shows, and people love me for it. And I'm like, you're on fucking Lovejoy. What's wrong with you?
Actually,
you were Matlock with better hair.
They named the bar in town that used to be a Lovejoy's after him because it was the only thing that both the owners agreed they liked enough to name a bar after.
Matlock with better hair.
All right, well, let's start talking about some of the movies that we saw, and we'll just kind of go around and name a movie that you enjoyed and start with Patience.
Well, the Audience Award winner for The Midnighters, 68 Kill, which I just mentioned earlier. I thought it was a pretty solid film. You know, I don't know if it deserved to win the Audience Award. I didn't think it was quite as memorable as some of other Trent Haga's films, particularly Dead Girl, which absolutely love. Dead Girl.
No, he wrote. He wrote.
I think he did. He direct Cheap Thrills.
No, that was Evan Katz. The only other feature he's directed is Chop from 2008, which nobody else has.
Okay, well, apparently I like his writing.
Then. Yeah.
So what's the plot of 68 Kill?
I'll do my best. So Matthew Gray Gubler plays Matthew Gray Gubler. and him and his whore girlfriend, who is literally a whore, she has like a sugar daddy that she goes and has sex with for money. Which Matthew Gray Gubler fully well knows this. They hatch a plan to steal his money, and things go awry, as they always are wont to do when you're dating a whore.
or commit a robbery.
So, you know, I had trouble with the movie because while I was watching it, I was like, okay, this is a solid film. But the next day I was like, I don't really remember that much about it. Hmm. And it was, I had been drinking as well, as you do at South By. But it wasn't that. It was just that I don't think it was particularly memorable. So I don't think it necessarily deserved the audience
I had very mixed feelings about it. I appreciate some of the things it was trying to do, but I felt it kind of, like, especially with the idea that the man is so, in this character, the lead character, he's so feminized here, and the women are the powerful, strong ones, even if they're all batshit insane. But in, without fail, they're all like, Jesus, you're a pussy, and he is. And then, but I felt like the end kind of, like, took away any of the power of that. I was like, oh, well, I was kind of enjoying that as a role reversal, but then by the end, I was like, yeah, okay.
The end paid off for me, because the end loops round to the first scene. So I think it absolutely paid off. I got to say, I think that was actually nicely circular.
The best line moment of the whole thing was from our buddy Sam Idison, who's cast in here as the whore's brother, who's like a serial killer, who like is, you know, he's just really scary when you see him through the first earlier part of the film. And then when he shows up, you know, kind of to save the day at one point, and he comes in and, you know, he should by all means want to kill this main character. And he looks down and sees him, oh, hi, Chip. Like, very uncharacteristically. Uh-huh. What just happened?
This movie, it also had a really nice performance from, I can't imagine she's been in anything else. I've been meaning to look her up. Alicia Bow, a Swedish-born actress. She's, like, the middle of the three girls. I thought she turned in a really great performance, and it was, like, a really nice contrast to the main girl, the whore, and the crazy goth girl at the end, just sort of being that right in the middle of both of them. I loved her character. I loved her performance.
You know, watching this, I kept thinking, it's like, I don't know if you're all familiar with Greg Araki, who did The Doom Generation. It's kind of Rose McGowan's big breakout. It felt like Greg Araki suddenly decided, wait a minute, I'm not gay. I'm aggressively heterosexual. And back at that period of time of his career, had made this movie. It's that same, like, ridiculously over-the-top sleazy and Grand Guignol, and just like, everybody is just scum.
It's like a trailer park around midnight, is what it felt like to me.
Yeah.
I mean, it's definitely got a lot of surprising and very funny moments in it, but I'm kind of still came out of it like you did. Like, I'm not really sure. I don't really understand why that won the audience award.
Yeah, I was much more fond of Two Pigeons, which I know I'm like the only person that was fond of Two Pigeons.
I would have loved the Midnighters probably picked Mayhem myself, but we'll get around to it. It's my turn. Martin, what about you?
A movie that... So I got to see... I didn't get to see a lot of films because I was running around mostly and... And probably a third of what I tried to see, I couldn't get into. But I saw The Most Hated Woman in America, which is the story of Madeline Murray O'Hare, at least her kidnapping and murder, her and her granddaughter and son. And it was,
which I think is turning up on Netflix very soon.
That's the thing, yeah. It's like, oh, I get into a movie, and the first thing it shows is Netflix original. I was like, oh, I could have just waited and watched it later. But I still did enjoy a great performance by Melissa Leo. As a matter of fact, I saw this thing before I'm Dying Up Here, which also had Melissa Leo. And this was mostly interesting to me because not only did I not know the details of the story, but I remember being in Austin when all this stuff was happening because I had interviewed for a graphic design job at the organization and gone up there right before all this went down. So it was very interesting to see that. But a movie I would talk about that doesn't have the Netflix distribution.
Or Melissa Leo.
No, it was a movie called Like Me, which I had no plans to see. But I'd gone to see Most Beautiful Island at State, and they kept us in line with problems they were going to work out that never got worked out. So the screening didn't happen. But in front of me was the director for this movie, Rob Mockler, who was just, you know, just some young guy and with his girl, and we just started a conversation, and he's very, he was just like, yeah, I'm here because I got a movie, but I'm at Most Beautiful Island because my friend directed it. And just talking to him, I was like, well, I like this guy, and this is showing him the next morning, and I got time, nothing on my schedule, I'll go see it.
Turned out to be a surprise?
Yeah, yeah. And it's mostly, it's mainly about this one girl who likes to do really screwed up things and film it and put it on the internet. And then all the trolls who comment on that. It's a lot of internet commenter troll culture.
But it's a narrative.
It is a narrative because she finds a guy that she kidnaps and just takes him on this bizarre road trip. It's a lot of sensory overload, obviously. Oh, did you see it?
Yeah, I saw it. It's really, and really well done. Really ambitious editing, ambitious camera work. It's funny, Jared Neese, the senior programmer for South By, introduced it, and he's always like very, you know, kind of jovial and joking in his introductions. He comes out and he's like, all right, guys, this is not a joke. if you have seizure issues, or if you're sensitive to that sort of stuff, this movie's not for you. Like,
I don't have to heard that with things. I mean, there might be a flashing screen or so.
Yeah,
but even if you aren't prone to seizures, you might want to be careful. Yeah. You know, you already have the spoon in your mouth at the time. Because yeah, there are some scenes where it just blasts the flashing and the, yeah, and the music back.
In addition to, like, the imagery is just, like, it's like, really, it's close-up shots of, like, people eating.
Yeah.
It's like, weird. Yeah.
It's jarring. It says, no, you're not going to not pay attention to what's going on. Even though it's a relatively simple story, but you can't tell, you can't predict where it's going to go next. Even though it works on a small scale. Right. But of all the things, I was like, you know what? I like coming to South by Southwest just so I can accidentally catch movies like this.
Yeah. And if for nothing else, I mean, fans of Larry Fessenden, who was in a bunch of movies this year.
And weirdly, didn't die in them all.
Yeah.
Which every year, Larry Fessenden extends the supercut of every death of his in cinema, because he has died in way more films he's been in than he survived.
Yeah. He's usually good for one or two scenes in a movie. He's just sort of that, like, hey, I like that guy.
He's a lucky mascot.
Yeah, he's in a lot of this movie. So.
Yeah.
If you want to see more about that, they have a Facebook page at Like Me the Film. Richard?
I had a really solid year for it. I thought there were a lot of really good films this year, individually, although the programming seemed very erratic, and a lot of people were kind of like, they didn't know why certain films were in certain categories. I know there were a lot of people who were very confused, for example, that The Honor Farm, which is great and kind of a fascinating Austin shot, psychedelic prom night thing, ended up in Midnighters, which felt like it much more should have been in Visions. I know a lot of people were very confused by this, and I think it got hurt a little bit by that, because people were like, I thought this was going to be a horror film.
Okay, even the description sells it as a horror film, which on the website, and you watch it and you're like, no, it's a kind of a coming of age of taking mushrooms with your friends for the first time story.
I like it a lot.
Even with those moments where you're like, I feel like something bad is going to happen, which is all the trailer shows you.
Yeah.
You think it's a horror movie, and it's totally not a horror movie.
But something that I could have readily taken its slot in the Midnighters, which actually won the audience the narrative award from the jurors, was Most Beautiful Island, which is fantastic. The first third feels like a Ken Loach movie set in contemporary New York, about a woman who, you know, she's kind of on the cusp. She's there quasi-legally, all her friends are undocumented. She's desperate for money, and then about a third of the way through, a friend of hers says, well, here's a thing, you know, you might want to work at this party and just get paid for it, and it's all cool, it's all fine. Well, it's not, and everything goes to a very interesting place.
Also, Larry Fessenden.
Larry Fessenden does turn up. Well, this is actually produced by Glass Eye Picks, as Larry Fessenden's production company, as was Like Me. But this is really the work of Ana Asensio, who's a Spanish actress. This is her directorial debut on features. She wrote the script, she's the lead, and it is fantastic. It goes from a really good social drama to suddenly being a super tense thriller, the middle act is basically just what's in the next room, and it sets that up, and it manages the remarkable thing of when you walk into that next room, it actually pays it off, which is incredibly tough because it's always anticlimactic. Not in this case. And it's a really fascinating character study about what you do to survive and for money. But it's beautifully done. It's not, you know, the classic, oh, I'm going to screw everybody over. It's really smart, really intelligent, really beautifully put together. You should be upset. I'm sure this is going to get distribution.
Well, I'm seeing that the co-star is Natasha Romanova, who is the Black Widow.
Sorry, yeah. Alexa has decided that I was talking to her.
Alexa can go away. Also,
this is at
mostbeautifulisland.com.
Also, Porto, which is one of Anton Yelchin's final performances, which is amazing. It's a three-chapter story about this couple in Porto, the Portuguese city, who they have a brief relationship, and every version of the story, as told in a different chapter, is a subtly different take. And it's not he said, she said per se. It's much more, you get different bits of information about each of them, and you kind of work, you get to the end of the first two chapters and you try to work out, why on earth would these be two people be together? And you know, what's their connection? And then the third chapter is heartbreaking and brilliant and wonderfully shot. It has one of the most explicit sex scenes I think I've ever seen in a South by film. But it doesn't feel exploitative. This thing is really a glorious, tiny, perfectly observed relationship drama. And the saddest thing is you watch it and you just think, God, Anton Yelchin was only getting better and better and better.
He really was.
Yeah, you watch this and the director reminded people at the end that he is the same age as his character, and his character is supposed to be 26, and you look at him and you just go, that's not a 26-year-old performance.
Yeah.
That's a 45-year-old performance. There is nuance and understanding and a grasp of how cinema works and a grasp of how people work that it was just, it's extraordinary. He's got a couple of other things still coming that are in the pipe. I think Porto was actually shot last, and it is phenomenal. Much more cheerful.
Wait. We're going to go around and give everybody a chance here.
Oh,
come
no, because I've got to go in a minute.
Oh, you have to go?
Yeah, okay. I've got to go. So I want to get this out. Win It All, which is the latest from a collaboration between Joe Swanberg and Jake Johnson. Jake Johnson plays a perennial loser gambler who an acquaintance, shall we say, says, hey, I've got to go to prison for a while, could you look after my bag? And he goes, yes, of course.
Just watching the trailer make me like cringe. What are you doing?
His friend played by Keegan-Michael Key goes, no, this is a terrible idea because you're going to look in the bag. And he looks in the bag and discovers there's a lot of money in there. And his friend goes, no, don't do that. And he goes, no, I'm just going to take a little bit of money and it's weird. It's in many ways a very conventional story. And it's almost feel good for Joe Swanberg, who, you know, comes out of what people want to refer to as mumblecore. But there's never such a thing. Really annoying term. But he tends to be more kind of, he's less story-oriented in most of his work. This actually is a very straight-ahead narrative where he lets Jake Johnson really just develop his character. And it's wonderful, it's heartwarming, it's kind of sweet, which again is not necessarily you think of when you talk about Joe Swanberg.
True.
But you know, I think this is in some ways one of his most accomplished films.
I think it's going to be on Netflix.
It's up there with Drinking Buddies as one that I think people are going to look at and go, oh, this is the point where he becomes, you know, he loses some of the sharper edges that put a lot of audiences off and becomes much more adept as a filmmaker as a whole rather than a storyteller and a developer of personality.
And I really like Drinking Buddies. I like working love Drinking with Buddies. Jake Johnson. They seem to be a good team together.
Oh, yeah.
Do Safety Night Guaranteed?
No, but
Digging for Fire.
Digging for Fire is there, yeah. Which it was fun. They were talking about that in the Q&A, and they were like, "Yeah, we thought we were doing a comedy with that," and then nobody laughed, and everybody went, "You've made a really dark film," and they're like, "We really have to reconsider our senses of humor at this point."
Yeah, I wanted to see that one. All three of the Netflix looked great to me, and I was like, "Yeah, but they're gonna be in Netflix like a month. I can wait." You know?
Yeah, but it was nice seeing it on. He shot it on. I think he actually shot it on Super 16. It had this nice graininess to it, which I think you know it is not going to transfer on Netflix. And that's one of the things. I'm very mixed on the whole. Well, it's going to turn up on Netflix or Showtime or blah blah blah, because there are times where this is the only time you're going to get to see it in this format. So even Porto, which is getting a theatrical release from Kino Lorber later in the year, and I do recommend you go see it, this is the only 35mm print. In fact, it was so freshly struck, they hadn't had time to send it to get the subtitles in some of the French-speaking scenes in laser-engraved, which I actually think worked better. And I actually talked to the director and said, dude, leave it off there. It leaves this wonderful ambiguity about these scenes, about what the characters are talking about. So if it turns up and it doesn't have subtitles on that scene, I'm taking credit.
That was Richard who did that. You send your hate mail to Richard.
Thank you.
Austin Chronicle. Christopher Ehrman.
Well, the one film I've spoken about before was Hounds of Love, which takes place in this 1980s Australian suburb, follows this serial killer couple who kidnaps this one girl, and it's pretty much just a bottle film where you kind of see everything from their different perspectives. So you follow the husband, you follow the his wife, or on-again, off-again serial killer girlfriend, and then also the kidnappee. And I just really liked it because it was a bottle film, and it really just focused on all the performances. I think that the kind of the 80s aesthetic kind of really worked. It made it feel, I don't know, pretty gritty. Obviously, the subject material itself is obviously very dark, but it really worked for me. And again, you're just there for those performances. And yeah, there's some stuff like kind of outside where you follow the parents of the person who is kidnapped, but you're just there for those three central characters. And I just want to add on to what Richard was talking about, Win It All. I think that movie works really well to see it in a theater because it's legitimately very funny. And I think that's kind of, you might miss it where you're not all, you know, if you're just watching on Netflix, you're not kind of experiencing it with an audience. It wasn't like an obnoxious, you know, festival audience. They didn't clap like during the opening credits, like, you know, like, oh, this so-and-so's name came up. No, it felt very natural. It's like, wow, this is, it was probably one of my most positive movie watching experiences at South by Southwest.
How many times have you wanted to turn around to the attending crew and cast who are there, who are like, nobody cares who the assistant producer is.
Yeah, exactly.
Stop cheering.
Or I think it's appropriate if an actor had recently passed away. Like when I went to go see the theatrical release of Alien, or that version of the film, everyone clapped for John Hurt. And sure. I thought that was very appropriate.
Of course.
You know, so that worked for me. But yeah.
Say on Hounds of Love, I got to see that one as well. And I'm really impressed with Emma Booth, who plays the wife of the two kidnappers.
Yes.
Who apparently has had quite the career, but not stuff we got to see as well, like in I believe Australia.
Yeah, this is a predominantly Australian cast and production.
Who has done apparently a decent amount of comedy in her career as well, but you never guess to watch this where she's really like, I mean, she's a significantly fucked up person who is in a wildly abusive relationship. You know, she's dating a serial killer.
Yeah,
and it's like, but she feels so totally unloved that she's willing to, like, yeah, we'll abduct girls and then you can murder them when you feel like
all for his all for his affection.
Yeah, all for his affection.
Yeah, and the actor is Steve Curry, who I think it does an excellent job as well.
I mean, my one complaint about this was it was just so unrelentingly sadistic that I was like, had a hard time watching it.
Yeah, I can understand that, but I mean, this is the type of situation where I think it would be. I mean, I think to not make it unrelenting sadistic would be kind of disservice for the film.
It's just a tough watch.
Sure. No, it definitely is. This is not a,
it definitely,
you know,
like, triggers all over the place for some people.
That's part of the reason why I skipped it, because the last two movies about Australian serial killers or Australian killings were Playground and the Snowtown Murders from Fantastic Fest.
Oh, Snowtown, Jesus.
And I was like, I read the synopsis and I was like, Australian murder, I'm done with those.
You can't forget Wolf Creek 1 and 2.
Apparently you can, I don't know. All right, we'll come back around. Kyle?
I am embarrassed to admit, I only saw one movie this year.
What?
Yeah, I only did one movie. I did a ton of design stuff and a ton of music, but I know the movie I saw is one everybody wants to talk about. And I've already messed the name up once tonight. Firefight, right?
Free fire.
Gosh.
That's what you originally said.
There was a firefight.
So,
that's my line.
Firefight.
Not the best name, in all honesty. It's like, it could be anything. It doesn't stand out.
But, I mean, that's so funny, because I remember leaving the theater going, oh, that's a really good name. Like, that's all they did, was just, you know,
that's pretty much
free fire.
The movie is, yeah. it is a firefight.
No, that's the synopsis. It's, what would you say the period was?
Sometime in the 80s?
Late
70s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It had just this really unique period feel to it, and I feel like it also, the story had a bit more gravity because, you know, the characters that were originally introduced, they are part of the Irish Revolution?
IRA.
And yeah, this is like an illegal gun deal that they're trying to broker with these other guys, and you know, you don't get 10 minutes into this film before somebody fucks up.
Well, I will say that the film, in a short period of time, really did set up the history that some of the characters have with each other. You get a good enough sense that when the firefight breaks out, you are somewhat invested in everybody. There was nobody I didn't care about, and it was all kind of like, how is this going to play off of them, and who's going to come out of it? And just a protracted free-for-all with everyone shooting at each other, that they could carry it for so long, is impressive and hilarious.
And there's some degree of, like, people switching sides during there are harsh feelings in between each group on each side, and, like, just weird shit like happens. Like, this is one of the characters they keep assuming is dead, and then he's not dead. And you're like, and then, of course, Brie Larson is in this, who, like people really like her on both sides, and kind of your two major protagonists on each side. You have Shelton Alto Copley on one side, who's a South African
gun dealer,
and then Cillian Murphy's the head of the IRA, and then Armie Hammer is this guy that came with Sholto Copley and Brie Larson, but he's kind of in the middle on some level. He's kind of like, guys, and he's like the sharp talking American, the slick looking guy. Yeah. But both sides like Brie Larson, and she keeps like, she's like, can I please leave now? Do I have to be here? My only issue with this at all was just that I saw it at the Paramount, and those speakers suck when you're watching something with heavy accents at points. And so there's a lot of dialogue. I have no idea.
And that was another thing that I thought was amazing about this film is you could tell they spent a lot of time thinking about the sounds of these bullets. You know, like where in the room they were, because I heard so many unique like bullet sounds, some that like felt like they just streaked, you know, for a minute, and others that were just like really quick and like caught you off guard and startled you. Mm-hmm. It was a great mix, incredible sound editing.
One of the things that this movie kind of addressed, I've always had a problem with like big action films, is how if you get shot, you die instantly.
Sure.
It's like, no, you get shot multiple times, and you're still going to live for a little while. You'll bleed out like in an hour and a half or something, but I like that they showed that was fun.
What about all that time you're waiting there?
Yeah.
Like 10 minutes into the actual firefight starting this film, everybody's got at least one bullet wound. They're all really pissed off about it.
Also, the actor who I forgot, it's Jack Rayner, who I thought was really, really good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, is that the guy who was like basically started it?
Yeah, he's the guy that started it.
Yeah, the whiny heroin addict.
Yeah.
It's just, there's a lot of really good humor. It's Ben Wheatley, who's definitely an experimental genre film guy who's only done one film I thought was kind of dull, A Field in England, but you know, he did a Kill List and High Rise, and he does stuff that's like off the beaten path. This is probably his most accessible, but even so, just the simple fact this is like one movie, one giant firefight, is in and of itself like, how are they gonna pull that off? Not really surprising to see Martin Scorsese as one of the executive producers of this thing. JC?
Well, it wouldn't be me if I didn't talk about sports a little bit.
Oh, boy.
So, South by is usually pretty good about having several sports documentaries, but this year there was pretty much only one, and it's called Disgraced. And I wanted to see it because it's a documentary of a story I've wanted to see for years. In early 2000s, in about 2003, Baylor basketball player Patrick Dennehy went missing, and was missing for about 45 days. And nobody knew where he was, and suddenly out of nowhere, his teammate, Carlton Dotson, confessed to murdering him out in the field, and didn't really give a reason why. And in the midst of everything that happened, what came to light was that the coach at the time, Dave Bliss, was paying him under the table. He previously coached at the University of New Mexico, and Patrick Dennehy was one of his star players, and when he came to Baylor, Patrick Dennehy came with him, and people always assumed that he was on scholarship, but there was no scholarships left, so he had to pay him under the table. And so when all of this came to light, Dave Bliss, in an attempt to save his job, was trying to convince the other players on the basketball team to tell people that the way Patrick Dennehy paid for college was that he was a drug dealer. And the reason why he got killed out in that field is because it was a drug deal gone bad. And one of his assistant coaches felt so bad about this, he secretly recorded these meetings happening, and that's how Dave Bliss lost his job. And it sparked a huge controversy amongst Baylor and amongst this coach who had been squeaky clean his entire career. It suddenly came to light how often he'd paid players, just how bad of a guy he was.
Jesus. I didn't know about any of this.
And the thing that this documentary points out is that the city of Waco, Baylor and sports is so important to that city, they will cover anything like this up as quickly as they can. Carlton Dotson, the guy who committed the murder, did have some mental issues and somehow agreed to plead guilty and pled guilty. No, because he pled guilty in a way where he didn't contest the charges, they immediately sent him to prison, closed the books, like no appeal, waived his right to appeal. Like, that thing was open and shut as quickly as he probably killed his teammate. And yeah, what's fascinating about it is it still uncovers a lot of information, but there's still a lot we don't know about this case. And yeah, Baylor and the city of Waco is really good at covering these things up.
It's so funny you say that, because Baylor University is constantly embroiled in some kind of public controversy. Mm-hmm.
I don't often ask questions in Q&As, but I did ask the director, in the wake of the sexual assault scandal that they're currently under, do you think that they'll attempt to cover it? He's like, I think they'll attempt to cover it. I think in 2017, with the advent of social media, it'll be hard for them to cover it up, but they'll try. And there's a line in the end of this movie where somebody talks about this specific scandal, and he the way he says the line, I'm probably gonna misread it. He said, the problem at Baylor was never Carlton Dotson or, you know, drugs. The problem at Baylor is the cancer of this administration and the cancer of this city. And if you don't take care of it, it'll come back. And he says that and just leaves it there like a fish on a table. And then, yeah, you start thinking about the sexual assault scandal. And I just two questions in the Q&A. I asked him, did that sexual assault scandal affect how you made this movie? And he goes, no, we tried not to let it. And he knew why I was asking. He said, if you're asking about that line at the end of the movie, that line was always going to be there. Because if this sexual assault scandal hadn't happened, something else would have.
Yeah.
Because that's the way Baylor and this town is run. It comes out on Showtime on April 12th, I think. So if you've got Showtime, this documentary will be there. The reason why I was so interested is, as much as I love sports, I remember when this happened. I was in school studying to be a coach at the time, and it was kind of always my dream to like work in collegiate athletics. And this whole thing at the time was just like, maybe I don't want to work in collegiate athletics. And it's sort of like, this scandal affected me that deeply, and it's why I've always wanted to see this story take place. And yeah, it's just as an amazing a story as it is. Even if you don't like sports, if you just like true crime, this is a really great documentary.
Right on. As a matter of fact, I do.
Well, one of the things I got to see that I really enjoyed and I did not expect I was going to enjoy was the work in progress, although it's hard to tell what's not done. Mm-hmm. Maybe there was a placeholder song. I don't know. It's not clear. For the disaster artist. One of the reasons I was very skeptical about this was, A, it's directed by James Franco, who so far as a director has had kind of a spotty career.
Sure.
Yeah. Where I admire his ambition, but his actual product he's come up with hasn't lived up to, you know, that ambition.
Yeah.
And this also, the second thing for me is that this is a true story about the making of that famous So Bad It's Good movie, The Room, directed and written and produced and starring Tommy Wiseau, with James Franco playing Tommy Wiseau, who is such a character, such an extreme character. I'm just really worried this is just going to be a really absurd caricature of a comedy.
Yeah.
And what ended up happening was not that at all. James Franco really put a lot of heart and work into both, into creating this film and specifically into the character Tommy Wiseau, who is a deeply troubled individual with lots of weird affectations and tics, who, by seeing this, you really get a very different view of The Room and him as a person.
Oh, really?
It's a very sympathetic viewpoint of this guy who, yeah, he's fucked up, but he just wants to be loved.
Is that Lisa, you're tearing me apart.
Yeah, it's mostly... go ahead, Herm.
No, you go ahead, Jesse.
It's mostly based on a book written by Tommy Wiseau's best friend and co-star in The Room. And a really good companion piece, if you ever see this movie, is to listen to the episode of The Room of the podcast, How Did This Get Made? Because a lot... and I happened to listen to that a few months ago before I'd even heard about this movie. A lot of what you may not understand if you just see this and have never seen The Room will be made a lot clearer in that episode. You learn about how mysterious Tommy was. You learn about their friendship. This movie kind of covers all that. And they do a really good job of convincing you that, I mean, maybe they really do love this movie, but they do a really good job of convincing you that they genuinely love this movie.
Yeah. Dave Franco plays the guy, his best friend and co-star in the film. I think Greg was his
Greg
name.
Something, yeah.
Yeah, and if anything, there's a weak point. It's only that, and apparently, like, the actual Greg is not much at all like Dave plays him. Dave plays him as sort of a wide-eyed neophyte, and apparently that was not really what was going on. He was kind of more amused by Tommy and going along with it than
anything
else.
Dave's is the weakest performance here. I'm convinced he can't really do anything but other than be Dave Franco.
It seems that way. But there's a huge cast of people who just seem to be like, oh yeah, I love The Room. I'll totally show up for 5 minutes and be in this, including like Seth Rogen, who's in it a good deal as the script supervisor, who for all extents and purposes is the second AD. Josh Hutcherson, Ari Grainer, Jackie Weaver, Allison Brie, what's his name? Zach Efron has a wonderful cameo as Steve R, who's a character, if you've seen in The Room, who beats up the little kid next door neighbor for no real good story reason.
I think he was on drugs.
That never goes anywhere. You're like, wait, you just do this whole thing like, why are you on drugs? And then it just is never discussed again.
When you saw Disaster Artist, you hadn't seen The Room.
I had not. I stuck around afterwards to watch The Room, which they played after.
Yeah,
which I was like, oh, okay. I think it would be even more baffling if I hadn't seen The Disaster Artist. Because it's like every piece of it makes no sense if you don't know all these things about Tommy Wiseau ahead of time.
Yeah.
But when you do, you're like, Jesus Christ, you really are an incompetent filmmaker. But this is exactly what was going on in your head at the time. Like, why do they constantly throw the football around in The Room? Yeah. They're constantly just in totally inappropriate scenarios. Come on, man, let's go toss a football. And it's because the first time he ever hung out with Greg, they went out and tossed a football. And so it was like, this whole movie is kind of like a bromance from, like, love letter from The Room, anyway, from Tommy to Greg.
Okay.
Do they ever discuss how Tommy got the money to make the movie?
Just as much as anyone knows, which is no one knows.
Yeah.
You know, there's a point where the Seth Rogen goes to the bank to cash the check, and he's like, so it went through? He's like, yeah. He's like, I was worried there wouldn't be money. He's like, the bank guy's like, we don't know where it comes from, but this account is bottomless.
That's astounding to me. And I, as mysterious as he is, I was surprised to see that he did show up for the panel, did he not?
Yes, he did.
That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, the guy who played, one of the characters, the guy who played the actual Chris R, was just there and showed up to ask a question. He's like, I played the actual Chris R. I'm like, what? Get up on stage! Chris, were you trying
to... No, I was going to say, from your description, it sounds like a modern-day Ed Wood.
That's the comparison everyone keeps making. Of course, it doesn't have that sense, you know, that Burton-esque sensibility of Ed Wood, of course, but, like, it's hard not to compare that it's a very sympathetic portrait of a very bad creative person.
Yeah, filmmaker, yeah, exactly. Cool.
Yeah. Patience?
Well, I want to say my favorite movie, and I know, was Leprechaun 5 in the Hood.
Oh, Jesus.
I'm just kidding. It was a good time, though.
It was Master Pancake.
It was hilarious. But no, my favorite movie was definitely Two Pigeons. I keep bringing it up. I know. This movie is a descent into complete and utter madness. I don't even know how to describe it. There's no blood. There's no gore. This is a horror movie.
I mean, there is a lot of grossness.
But there is a ton of grossness to the point where, like, my fellow audience members were literally, and myself included, were squirming in our seats just uncomfortably, like, oh my God, I can't watch this.
More than a few times I heard people literally going, oh,
I did. I gagged a couple times too, but I was a little hungover, as you are during South by Southwest. But the reason why I really like this movie, first of all, it's about a man who lives in a flat in London. And he doesn't know that he has someone who lives with him. And so, you know, it's like that urban legend, you know.
He's the hider in the house.
Yeah, the hider. Oh, okay. You know, someone's living in your house and you don't know it. So that, to me, that's just terrifying to begin with. But Javier Botet plays the hider in the house. And
he's a weird looking dude.
He is such he's usually the monster that you see, like, at the end of Wreck, Mama. He's the one that has, he's super tall and extremely, like, you know, emaciated. Mm-hmm. Doesn't he have, like, some sort of disease?
It's not the same guy from those movies.
No, it is.
But, no, he's not from Wreck, because that guy died, like, a year ago.
Oh, well, he's from Quarantine, then.
Yeah, maybe. He might have been in Quarantine.
I know for sure he was Mama.
Okay.
He plays this monster, you know, in all of these movies. And in this movie, it was like he was a human, for one. And he played a very human performance, albeit a nasty one. And which all makes sense in the end. But you still can't really... It's hard to find sympathy for a guy that messes with your toothbrush.
Yeah, dude's taking the guy's toothbrush and, like, putting it in his ass and stuff. Oh. And, like, he uses his mouthwash and then spits it back in the mouthwash bottle.
It's really quite disgusting. But, man, that movie stuck with me. The next... I haven't stopped thinking about it. And so that was definitely my pick of all the movies I saw.
I would pay money to someone to make me stop thinking about it.
Well, that's why I co-host Deliberations of Doom. That's my jam.
Martin, I know you got to run soon, so why don't you just run through the stuff that the other stuff you want to bring up?
Well, okay, so I didn't see much of any other movies. I saw Baby Driver, but I feel like we talked about that.
We did.
One thing, because the festival, at least for me, it's always so much fun until about Wednesday.
Right.
And that's when the music kicks in. A lot of the free stuff starts to dwindle, or if not, just directly go away. I'm not really trying to hit the music clubs, and I figure, oh, I'll go see films now. But I guess everybody gets that idea. And stuff at the Alamo, it's just like, man, my trek over there to try to see stuff was just like an exercise of futility. But something I did do was, speaking of comedy, Kyle and I were supposed to go see to the Hannibal Buress show party at the Trinity Hall, and that was one of me...
The Schlotsky's party?
Yeah, the Schlotsky's party.
Yeah, the man kept me down on that one.
Hey, man, it's... You know what? So here's what happened with that.
It's so funny, because my boss at the end of the day, she goes, all right, that's it, now go to your show. And I go, I was supposed to be there 2 hours ago.
It would have been just as well.
Yeah.
Because I got there maybe, I want to say an hour. Maybe not quite an hour early.
That was my plan. It started at 4:00. I was going to get there at 3:00.
Okay. So I'm in line there, and the line starts moving. And it moved in increments. And so getting up there. So by the time I got around to where, sort of kind of by the front door, but not really, like halfway up the block that would turn the corner into the front door, Grant finally joined me, and it was 5:00 at that point. And I'm like, all right, I don't know what the deal is. Like, it's already 4:00. It's already 5:00. Yeah. Almost 5:00. It should have started at 4:00. And Grant says, let me go walk up there and find out. And he said, oh, yeah, at this point, they're just letting one in, one out.
Oh,
and,
no.
And now I'm at that kind of, like, cross the Rubicon part, but I'm also thinking, like, all right, look, I'm not going to get that hour back. And I'm not going to wait out here just to go into some place that's packed, waiting for somebody to leave so I can get in there. So I just said, fuck it, let's go. And we walked, I said, let's walk over to Esther's and just see, maybe there's something we can catch. And we go, we see the line, I'm thinking they're going to turn us away. They go like, nope, we haven't given out the cue cards yet. Here you go. And it was for the Hannibal Buress podcast. So I'm like,
well, son of a gun.
Yeah, so how's he going to be there if he's here?
Wait, this is starting to make more sense now with him showing up at all these different
places. Right, there's more than
he's got that thing Hermione had in the third Harry Potter.
I was wondering about that Schlotsky's party because I remember Hannibal Buress was going to be there, and I was like, no, I really want to see the Big Sick instead. And then he was crashing the Q&A for the Big Sick. Right. I was like, did he even go to the Schlotsky's party?
Well, we go in, and sure enough, we see him do his podcast with a couple of guests on. One of the guys, Byron Bowers, was hilarious. He was the most hilarious guy he had up there. I even like met him. I went to use the bathroom after he was off, bumped into him, and him and Charlie Sotelo was sitting there talking. Hmm. And so I got to talk to him for a bit, and that was really cool. So we got out, and then on our way downtown, just walking around looking for stuff, passed by the Trinity Hall, and there's a window you can look in and see. There were other comedians on stage, but not Hannibal Buress, so I don't know if he ever showed up or whatever. So, yeah, that's how that went.
Hmm. But I'm kind of glad
podcast,
I missed out.
The podcast was funny, except for the fact that once we got in there, Esther's is not a big place. Mm-mm. So we're like, hey, we're in. But the only seats available had a giant tower of speakers right in front. I mean, I'm sitting almost front row, but the tower of speakers is there. And I was like, any chance you guys going to move these? They're like, no, why would we do that? I guess so the audience could see, but okay, never mind. Damn. So I could see a quarter of it if I lean to the left, and a quarter if I lean to the right.
Kind of like at the Paramount. I'm like, is there any really good reason to still have those balcony seats when literally 20% of the theater is missing, like 50% of the screen or more, depending on where they're sitting because of those
balcony
seats?
They're fancy.
But yeah, that was pretty much my other than going to the music thing I went to on Friday, that was pretty much the last of it for me.
Yeah?
Yeah.
No more good movies?
No, afraid not.
No?
That was like I said, I wasn't able. Yeah, I would have loved to have seen A Most Beautiful Island.
Yeah. Well, like I said, next year when you, assuming you do the panel again with Richard,
yeah,
go to contact the South by people, the registration people, and say, look, I actually would like to do coverage for this as press as well. So anyway, you can add press to my thing. Right. And they don't, that's no skin off their back to do that. So okay. You've got a badge already. All that does is put you on the list for all the distributors to send you emails saying, hey, you want a screener?
Well, it does give you two extra express passes if you take the time to go down there and get express passes.
Yeah. Here's the thing I'm curious about express passes. So either you get in line for the film 2 hours early, or you go wait 2 hours for an express pass.
The thing is, and this is a trick I've learned after a few years, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, yeah, don't bother with the express passes because you have to get there way early. But like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday,
yeah,
you can stroll up 9:30, 10, and there'll still be a good amount of stuff that you can not have to wait in line for and just get the express passes for.
Well, right on, JC. Thank you
good
for that.
Know.
Right, you know?
Very good to know. All right, kids, I'm out of here.
All right, thanks, Martin.
Oh, you betcha. Appreciate it. Chris Herman.
I lied. I did go to one music thing. I actually went with Martin to something, which was like this kind of like jazz or blues club. It's kind of done the same style as like La La Land Sebs, which I thought was really, really cool.
Oh, that's right. That yeah. Was awesome.
So that was a lot of fun. Had a lot of free drinks. But yeah, and yeah, in terms of films, that was pretty much it for me. I do want to speak a little bit on some of the gaming stuff, if that's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I did gaming too.
You did? Yeah, awesome. But yeah, so.
I followed Chris Herman and Jason around with the camera. My experience with that.
but yeah, I mean, mostly the focus for the South by Southwest gaming is a lot of independent developers, a lot of small types of things, mostly like available on Steam or kind of like they want to get on like the bigger platforms eventually. But
there was a new thing nobody's really heard of called the Nintendo Switch.
Yeah, I was going to get to that, except for this whole Nintendo presentation, which was really impressive.
It was super cool. That was, like, was. My favorite part. So was my demoing friend, the Switch.
Tim Doyle is a pretty well known poster artist. At Flatstock, you know, their mm-hmm. thing for poster art there. And he's like, I'll give you $50 right now if you go get me a Nintendo Switch hat. And I was like, I'm not standing in line for 3 hours for $50. Thank you very much.
That's how long you have to wait for that thing. Yeah. I mean, I kind of looked at the Nintendo Switch presentation from afar. Like, we can get up close to it and everything like that. But, yeah, they showed off Mario Kart 8 Deluxe, Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, which does look beautiful on that thing. They did, like, kind of hand out, like, hey, you want to hold the Switch for a second? Hmm. Okay, now we're going to take it back from you. So I didn't get to hold it. It's like, I have a lot of complaints about the system, but it feels good in your hand. So
I demoed the Zelda. For
okay.
I did the 20-minute demo.
Nice.
There was no line, so I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. Nice. So, actually, I thought it was really intuitive. You can play it. I didn't play it as a handheld. I played it as a console.
Okay, so you had the...
So, yeah. you have the dual controllers, and you also, they do have a traditional controller that you put the dual controllers on top as well.
Yep.
If that's your thing. I liked the dual controllers. It took me... I mean, I wouldn't say I'm, like, the greatest gamer in the world, but I would say it took me less than 5 minutes to, like, get used to it. I'm a Sony fangirl, so I was like, what the hell is an A button, you know?
Yeah.
So once sure. I got that under control, I thought it was great, and Zelda is amazing. I like to think of it as kind of like a cartoony version of Skyrim. Mm.
Sure, I can see it that way.
Strong words.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I liked it.
And a lot of people are loving that game. And what I just see, one more comment on Zelda. It feels to me like a remake of the original game, where it doesn't tell you what, it gives you one objective, defeat Ganon. And that who's the bad guy in Legend of Zelda. And that's all you have to do. Like, you can immediately go to the castle where he's at and try to beat him, but he's, like, this godlike being. And so you have to kind of explore the world at your own, leisure. And then progressively get more powerful, unlock these different dungeons and, like, shrines. And that's really cool. And I'm glad Nintendo is definitely doubling down on showcasing that game, because that's the only thing they have right now, in all honesty, in terms of software. But yeah, I mean, some of the more independent games that I really liked was Antihero, which is kind of like this Charles Dickens-inspired kind of like multiplayer game, where you play like a Charles Dickens-like character, like Oliver Twist or David Copperfield, but instead of, you know, acting like those characters, you assassinate people, or you steal things from them, or, you know, kind of set up your little urchin crime ring. But you're basically like Fagin, you know, from that, which I think is really cool. And then probably one other game was, I think, called Stranded or Strander or something like that. Just give me one second. But it was kind of inspired by kind of a Metroidvania type game. So if I think something like Super Metroid or Castlevania. except where instead of progressing to the level, you don't encounter enemies. The enemies all come to you. So if you don't move fast enough, then you can get swarmed and die a lot.
Metroidvania, or is that just a
that's the style of game where it's like a combination between Super Metroid.
Yeah, I was like, is it just Castlevania where everyone's really well dressed?
Sundered, my mistake. Sundered. That's game. And then yeah, just two more. Earthfall, which is think of Left 4 Dead except more of a sci-fi aesthetic. So you're fighting like these aliens, and you're trying to kind of uncover this conspiracy with this alien invasion. It's basically Left 4 Dead with more of a narrative, which I think is really cool. Hopefully, I'll be speaking with that developer.
Awesome.
Yeah, it's really cool, and hopefully, I'll be speaking with that developer soon, doing some stuff for oneofus.net maybe.
Right on.
And another game was called Bootleg Systems, actually by one of the former developers for the new Far Cry games, so Far Cry 3, 4, and Blood Dragon. It's kind of this 80s-inspired kind of neon first-person shooter where all your ammunition in the world is like certain objects. So if you happen to pick up a chair, you fire chairs or people or body parts. It's like it's pretty cool.
Yeah, I saw that one. That was pretty fun.
Yeah,
that was pretty kind of Tron-y.
Very Tron-y. Yeah, yeah. A lot of neon lights.
Yep. Kyle, do you have anything else you wanted to?
You went to a lot of parties, didn't you?
Oh, we all went to a lot of parties.
A lot of drinking. Oh. Yeah.
Oh my gosh, favorite parties. Okay, best food was the moonshine party. Who was with me at that?
Not me.
Oh my gosh, I think it must have been
awesome. Moonshine is awesome.
Food. Yeah. Me and Martin. Oh my gosh, yeah, tons of moonshine food. Actually, the best party, hands down, it was Free Fire, the premiere, Grant wanted to get there, and we all kind of hung back, and he left early and I'm waiting in line the whole time. Herman and I show up, like, last minute. We just walk right in. No problem at all. Which was awesome because we were at a great party and we were just, like, slamming cocktails. You pulled out some champagne bottles out of your bag. We were, like, sipping champagne up on the balcony. Well, then the next night, the same thing happens in reverse. It's Pennywise and Jimmy Eat World. And I'm like, really? I mean, these are two of my favorite bands from, you know, way back. And I get there an hour early, end up waiting in line for an hour and a half. Grant goes over to the Visa party. They bought out Bruin' Brew, which is a taproom / coffee house here in Austin. Great balcony, great beer selection. The party had catered barbecue, and all the taps are free. So he sat there and drank while we waited in line for an hour and a half, and then was able to walk right into the party, and he was right up at front. While we were watching the bands.
This is the very definition of South by Party. Yep. Was when you and I were walking around.
Oh.
And we just look up at the Driscoll balcony and see these people up there. And I was like, they got paper plates.
That must be food.
It's a buffet. And we just walk up there. And the guy's like, you here for this party? We both look at each other like, yes.
Or no. What it was is we're walking up the stairs and I see a sign that says BMG.
Yeah.
And we're walking up and he goes, are you guys trying to find the balcony? And I go, no, we're here with the BMG party.
Yeah.
And then you go, yeah, yeah, we're here with BMI.
Yeah, yeah.
And the guy was like,
what?
All right, come on right up here.
Well, we walk in, this dude, I have no idea.
Yeah, and like,
comes right up to us. Guys, what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to go out towards the balcony because the bar out there, you can get a drink right away. You get some food over there. We're like, okay.
Thanks. That's exactly the information I needed.
That's what we did.
Didn't bury the lead at all. But yeah, no, great tacos. And then got to get a cool time lapse on the Driscoll balcony.
It's kind of fun talking. We met these two guys, record guys from Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And we're just talking to them. The dude's like, oh, you know, in his, I'm not going to try and do a Copenhagen accent.
It was very different.
I love your iHeart PBS pen. I was like, well, then it's yours. Here, take it. He's like, oh, I can't believe you gave me a pen.
That's cute.
I was like, oh, I've had it for two years now. It's time to move it on.
Somebody else. Spread the love.
JC?
I didn't partake in a lot of parties this year, but I did constantly go into the one time I was able to meet up with you guys in that Wix lounge.
Mm-hmm.
Where everybody was experimenting with liquid nitrogen. There was a food trailer there for that had I was surprised. It was a bunch of food trailers this year that had like cones, which is basically just like putting a tortilla in a cone shaped thing.
Cones are real big,
and
right?
Putting
was it
meat in it.
A mighty cone?
Well, that one wasn't, but it might have been the same thing. And
I think that was the name of the food truck. But yeah, you're right.
But yeah, that lounge did all kinds of experiments with liquid nitrogen. They had some like agave nectar that you would basically just put in a bowl and pour liquid nitrogen on top of it, and it would instantly freeze it, and it became like a slushy at that point, and it, that wouldn't melt. So that was really good.
You missed. I don't think you got there early enough for the food, did you?
Yeah, I got some of the food.
The caterer is pink. I think it's called Pink Avocado.
Oh, Pink Avocado.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
God. What,
yeah.
That food was amazing.
Are you talking about the brisket and the macaroni and cheese bites?
Yeah, I was there two different days, and I had the brisket, and then they had a mini taquito one. Yeah, yeah. That was good.
So good. But I meant more, what's another movie that you like?
Oh, I was looking down the list, and earlier you mentioned Mayhem, so we could probably talk about
Let's talk about Mayhem.
Yeah. It's from Joe Lynch, who, I mean, I can't imagine he's done the most recent thing I think he's done that people might have seen on Netflix was The Knights of Badassdom.
Which was not very good.
Right. And that one...
Everly is his, like...
Everly, that's his most recent film. One, yeah. Knights of Badassdom, he'll say, was wrestled away from him, the producers, and it probably was. But this one seems... almost on paper like a similar premise to what the Belko experiment might be. I still haven't seen that, but basically Steven Yeun from The Walking Dead, he's an attorney in this giant corporation in this world that exists a virus that completely lowers all inhibitions to a dangerous level. It doesn't lower inhibitions to like make you want to run around naked or something. It makes you want to just like, if you've ever wanted to punch your boss in the face and you have this virus, you're going to punch your boss in the face.
I think they say at one point it removes your moral center completely.
Yeah, it removes your moral center.
You just have no morals left.
Yeah.
So you're still totally reasonable, like in terms you can talk to people in a normal way, but if you're like, I want to kill this guy in your head, you're going to try and kill them right then and there.
That's cool. And so it's very absurd, super violent, kind of funny in some ways. But I just had a lot of fun with it, and it's loud and bloody, something that Steven Yeun must have had a lot of fun making.
Strong notes to Samara Weaving, who is kind of a newcomer, but apparently has a lot of stuff lined up in front of her, and I'm not surprised. She plays a woman who he initially, you know, rejects her, like, claim to try and, like, get rid of the foreclosure of her house.
Oh, yeah.
Even though she has the money, it's like, oh, it's too late, sorry.
Yeah.
But then when he loses his job through... I don't even know what you call it precisely, when basically someone else, like higher up, decides someone lower his head is going to fall from the axe for something they did.
He gets set up for something he didn't do.
So the two of them, when the virus comes in and they find out, oh, there's a legal precedent for if you have the virus, you're not culpable legally for anything you do. They're like, we're going to go up floor by floor to the top of this building and take out every prick that got both of us in the shitty situation
we're
in. And it's so much fun.
Yeah.
It's bloody, it's funny, it's creative, lots of creative kills in here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, definitely my favorite thing from Joe Lynch so far.
It's, and yeah, I've got to imagine that it would at least make an interesting double feature with something like the Belko experiment. When I do see that, I'm sure they're pretty similar, but yeah, different in their own sense.
Is this more horror comedy?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And like, it's not gory to the point that people who are weird about gore are going to get freaked out, you know? I mean, it's bloody, but it's not like... super intensely, like,
in,
yeah,
bloody.
Exactly. It's just, it's fun. It's another sort of like, it's a lot of sense of relief if you've ever had a boss you fucking hated. It's one of those movies. You're like, yes, these guys are steadily taking out all the pricks who work over them, who've been
definitely
fucking them
not
over
Chris
for years.
Cox.
Definitely.
No.
So one of the ones I really loved, and maybe my favorite film of the festival is The Big Sick. Weird name, I know, directed by Michael Showalter, who's a comedian who you've probably seen in stuff from like the show Stella. He was on part of Wet Hot American Summer and directed that as well. I created a number of television projects. This is definitely his most mature work yet. If anything else, and I hate to say this because people are going to go, oh, what? So there's another, like, you know, Indian / Pakistani guy, and so you're going to compare it, but it does remind you on some level of Aziz Ansari's show
Master of None?
Yeah, Master of None to some level, because it's very relationship-oriented and sort of like the difficulties of being a comedian who is a person of color and the things that come with that, but this is definitely more... here it's Kumail Nanjiani. This is, you know, more focused in the sense that it's just this one story that's based very closely on his real life story of how he met his wife Emily, here played by I just adore her, Zoe Kazan.
I was really hoping she was going to be there for the viewing. Yeah, I was bummed out that she wasn't.
And the weird thing where like they got together and they were really close, and they broke up because when she found out, he hadn't even told his parents she existed, because he was like, hadn't really put it through his head that even though I love this girl, I can't marry her because my parents and family would disown me.
So like a reverse Get Out.
And, you know, they break up, and then it turns out she's in the hospital and has, like, this incredibly deadly illness that they she didn't know she had, and he kind of falls... he just goes to his head, he figures out his whole life through realizing, you know, helping take care of her, meeting her parents, played by Holly Hunter and Ray Romano, who are both terrific this thing. What he really wants and what's important to him. And, I mean, he's playing, I mean, like I said, he's a up-and-coming stand-up comedian at the time, and this is just funny, it's heartwarming, and you will cry. You know, there are moments you're just like, Jesus Christ, just, like, deeply emotional moments. And you like everybody in it. I mean, just the...
Even Ray Romano?
Ray Romano is so...
Ray Romano. Man, everybody loves Raymond. Come on.
He's so good in this.
No, he really is. The dynamic between him and Holly Hunter is terrific. Okay. Believe this old married couple that has had definitely problems, in fact, some recent problems, but do definitely really love each other.
Yeah, I feel like it would have been a good movie if you could have just put anybody in the role of the parents, but being Holly Hunter and Ray Romano, I think elevated from like, we were not giving scores in this thing, but elevated it for me like from like an 8 to like a 9. Like it was that great, and they were so good in it.
And this was also one of the audience award winners. I can't remember which one.
It's for festival favorites, I think.
Yeah,
because it played Sundance and did really well at Sundance.
It's really a don't miss comedy that has like their points of it that feel vaguely Apatow-ish, and he is involved in the making of this, executive producer, but not to the point where you ever feel like, oh, just improv it and we'll take the best parts. Like,
One of the interesting questions in the Q&A was somebody asked of what outweighed more, the comedy or like the truth of the story, and Kumail said there's a lot of truth in this. Like, pretty much most of it is truth. There's a few exaggerations. They probably inserted some jokes that he didn't insert in real life.
They also don't... they period move it up to now.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not like, okay, this was 10, 15 years ago. It's clearly what was supposed to be more recent.
Yeah. And if Hannibal Buress was his roommate at the time, he's definitely not in this movie.
Yeah, he's his roommate, and I don't remember the name of the comedian who's playing him, but...
Just somebody
like
named Chris.
Incompetent comedian who's like, everybody else is starting to do really well and get noticed, and he's like the one guy who's like, not, clearly not along for the ride, because he's awful. And they're all like, they all really like him, but they're like... Yeah, sorry, man.
I loved him. If Cap City had somebody that awful there every night, I would watch him.
He was in the room of comedians.
That's funny.
Now, patience?
Oh, did you have a last word?
No, I just want to say, is this coming to Amazon?
I believe Amazon is... Well, I mean...
It's going to have a small theatrical release, but Austin will be one of the cities in June.
Yeah. Okay, cool.
And then we'll probably end up on Amazon Prime.
Nice.
Yeah.
The only other movie I watched was Lake Bottom, and I really don't know if I have that much to say about it, to be honest with you. It was okay. It was a solid film. You know, this was one of those things where if I saw it on Netflix, I would give it like a solid 3 out of 5 stars. You know what I mean? Like, which is my like go-to, you know, rating. It does have this nice little play on the slasher film that I liked a lot. Basically, it's about, these murders that happened in the 70s. 4 campers were murdered in their tent, and these 2 kind of creepy pervy guys want to recreate this event. So they talk these 2 girls into going to recreate it. And at one point you find out that one of the girls, who comes from an extremely religious family, had nude pictures leaked of her, and so she's like can't show her face in public and is like deeply humiliated because everyone at high school, it's high school, even in Scandinavia, I think it might be in
Finland,
thank you,
it's all the same
thing. Scandinavian, right?
Sure.
So they go out to this the boys trick them and they tell the girls that they're going to this big cabin party when in fact they're really going out there to recreate this
Just, yeah, to sleep in a tent that's just sleep, like the one with the murder took place.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
So
only
and then
to have the tables turned on them in a very bizarre way.
It starts out exactly like you would expect your, you know, typical slasher in the woods film. You know who's going to be your final girl.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Immediately. However, I want to say about the second act, things change. And then the third act, things change again.
Yeah.
So, I want to say it was pretty solid. I would definitely wait for it to come out on streaming.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting horror film. It does some turns, twists and turns that I've never seen before in a movie.
Yeah, exactly.
And it ends in a weirdly sort of ambiguous, like, wait, did that happen did that not happen? And a sort of suddenly introducing that a whole sequence of this movie may have been an unreliable
thought the ending was the weakest point, the very, very ending,
right.
I thought was like, that was unnecessary. Mm. But you know me.
Yeah.
You know how I like. I don't want to give it away.
I liked it overall, and I could see why some people would like it a lot more than me, but I agree with you in general. It's kind of like, it felt like it needed a little bit more.
Just
a little pass on the script or something.
Yeah. Mm.
Herman?
I just saw one other film, pretty unique. It's called The Archer. It's about a, 17, 18-year-old girl who uses a bow and arrow.
Okay.
really, it just kind of follows this, this girl who's part of this kind of, she's like an Olympian level, like, archer. She gets in trouble for beating up her best friend's rapist. She gets sent to this kind of, like, all girls, like, prison camp or juvenile delinquent kind of facility. And, you know, it's kind of this whole thing where it's, like, her trying to escape with this other girl, and they're being pursued by pretty cartoony-like villains for the most part. Like, all the male characters in the film are either rapists or murderers or criminals of some kind.
Is this Hunger Games?
Well, as I said, it's such a unique concept, you know? But really, I think it's a fine film. Some of the action scenes are good. Some of the performances are okay. Really, the main person in the movie, who I forget her name, but who plays the archer, the titular archer in the film, she's pretty good. But, you know, it's a solid kind of thriller-type movie.
Yeah? We're seeing?
On Netflix, something like that. I don't know about in the theater.
Yeah.
And that was called The Archer?
The Archer.
And that's from Mar Vista Entertainment. Not sure when that's coming out. I don't have information on that. But, a lot of people actually put that on their Best of the Festival list.
Yeah.
So,
no, I
didn't see it.
It's a crowd-pleasing film.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're going to actually wrap this up unless anybody else has anything they have to bring up.
No.
Okay. I would like to say to you guys, first off, thanks for listening. Second, we did put out reviews for some other stuff that are on videos. So if you look either on our YouTube channel or I did posts for each of them. We review Atomic Blonde. We review America, the Pilot of American Gods, a couple other things. And there's also Q&As up for some stuff, including the full Q&A for American Gods, Atomic Blonde, and The Disaster Artist. So check that out. And there will be another video of the coming up very shortly, which may be out before this, of Chris Herman at the video game section of the whole thing.
Yeah, awkwardly talking about all the games I forgot about, yes.
And a few more things besides. But thanks for listening, and you know what? Just come for Fantastic Fest and join us, because then we'll put you on a microphone and have you talk about what you saw. If you come up and say, I love your show, can I talk?
That'd be fun.
Yeah.